This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Killing people is wrong, right? We learned this in kindergarten, maybe at church, or from our parents. But that's not the whole story, says Harvard professor Mark Hauser. In his new book, Hauser argues that every human is born with an innate moral grammar, an intrinsic sense of right and wrong. From the Inuit hunting seal in Alaska to the taxi driver in New York, we all came into this world, he claims, with a universal framework of morality. This hour on Point, we're talking about human nature and whether, despite all evidence, we are hardwired to be moral. Joining me in the studio is Mark D. Hauser, professor of psychology, evolutionary biology, and biological anthropology at Harvard University. He's author of the new book, Moral Minds: How Nature Designed Our Universal Sense of Right and Wrong. Mark Hauser, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, great to be with you. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Professor Hauser.
Hi.
All right. Mark Hauser, last time it was Wild Minds, now it's Moral Minds. You've got to do a lot of educating for us here, and we've got to have a few arguments about this. But just for starters, what are you talking about? Hardwired morality. We look at history, it's full of the most heinous, immoral crimes imaginable. I mean, just on the face of it, I can imagine many people saying, what do you mean we're hardwired for morality? Doesn't look like it.
Good. Well, let's unpack two simple things right to begin with. The first is to distinguish between what people actually do versus how they judge certain situations. And what I want to argue in the book and what I have argued is that trying to explain what people actually do in real-world moral scenarios is very, very different than how people judge certain situations.
So we may have the right impulse or the right judgment, but we don't act necessarily on it.
That's right, because lots of things will intrude in what people actually do. So, for example, I can remember myself having a situation where my daughter was kicked by a young boy when she was very little, and the first thing was to respond and grab that kid and do something violent with him. Now, if I was asked, was that the right thing to do, the answer would have been no. But lots of things intrude. My thinking isn't clear. My emotions are getting in the way. It's my daughter versus somebody else's kid. All those things make it a very complicated story. So the first thing is, let's get clear on what we do in real-world situations versus how we judge things. That's the first point.
Mm-hmm. Action versus
judgment
of thought.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The second point is that when we argue for something being biological, we are not talking about something which is fixed, immutable, unchangeable, and non-vulnerable to cultural influences. Even things like our capacity to speak, to produce different languages, is something that is heavily influenced by our local cultural experiences.
We speak different languages.
We speak different languages, exactly. Mm-hmm. So the view that I have is that there are some aspects of the mind that we share as a species that will guide us towards certain kinds of judgments. The local culture can refine those, giving us locally specific kinds of moral perception.
This is such a radical idea. I mean, the widely shared notion, at least in many religions, in Christianity, is the fallen human being, that we are not fundamentally moral, but fundamentally fallen from grace, away from morality. And we've got centuries of humans trying to build a structure of moral reasoning. And before that, religion, that would give us a framework to hold on to. I mean, you're making a huge claim here, and you specifically say you got to move away from moral reasoning and understand this more biological base. You even say we need to divorce morality and religion, that those don't work together. These are so counter-historical. are you putting you're putting an awful lot of weight in this moral instinct?
I'm putting a lot of weight in terms of a scientific endeavor that is allowing us to begin to understand what sort of the structure, the architecture of the mind is in terms of how we perceive the world of moral dilemmas. That's not to say that religion, government, law, all have a place to play in what we actually do and in constraining what we actually do. So here again is something that I think is a classic sort of trap that often people will fall into. It's between a description of what the biology guides us towards in terms of our perception of the world as opposed to what we ought to do. So, for example, our biology may form ways of perceiving the world in terms of what is right and wrong in terms of harming somebody. We may reflect upon that output and say, you know what, that's not how the world should be. So let's take a very simple example, maybe a little bit less intense than we might go towards. Take the notion of animal rights, something that's a very recent phenomenon. 30, 40 years ago, there were no animal rights. We could do what we wished with animals. Mm-hmm. And now, in sort of the words of Peter Singer, we've expanded the moral circle. We've expanded the realm of individuals or organisms that we treat with some notion of what is fair, what their rights are.
Some people have free the minks, stop the testing
That's
on
right.
animals.
Yeah. That's so right.
Does that mean that somewhere in our brains a moral muscle has grown, some physical, biological thing, or is this just acting on a deeper framework?
Well, so I would say it's acting on a deeper framework and making here the analogy, which I do throughout the book, between thinking about morality in some of the same ways that linguists in the sort of the Chomskyan tradition have thought about language itself.
This is Noam Chomsky who said we've got some kind of base patterns here that are bread in the bone.
That's right. So there is a theory of a universal grammar for language that all humans share. It's part of our species heritage. In the same way, I would like to argue that there's something about our species heritage that gives us a universal moral grammar. These are abstract principles that guide us towards thinking about the world in terms of harming and helping others, but it's the local culture that will tweak how those specific principles get instantiated in the local culture.
We're going to have to look at the evidence for what's in there in evolutionary biological terms. But Jack Media, I want to get you in the middle of this. I mean, here we are being told, hey, you wild things, you got a fundamental moral bone. Do you believe it?
Well, you know, Huckleberry Finn believed it.
Oh, then it must be true.
deep down in Arkansas, he finally reflects that he's run away with a slave. And the thing he's got to do is write a letter to Miss Watson telling her this terrible thing he's done. And he's going back and forth and he's saying, I was letting on to give up sin, but away inside of me, I was holding on to the biggest one of all. I was trying to make my mouth say I would do the right thing and the clean thing and go and write to Jim's owner and tell her where he was. Mm-hmm. But deep down in me, I knowed it was a lie. You can't pray a lie. I found that out. So Huck is struggling with the code of his society, which says the right thing to do is to write to Miss Watson, tell her about Jim, and he's struggling with that.
And return the slave to slavery.
Yes, right. And he's against that. There is this, what does he say, this thing deep down inside of me, his connection with Jim that seems to transcend culture and society and maybe issues from this moral mind.
But Jack, I mean, look at Mark Twain and the dark view that he took as his life went on. Look at the teachings of centuries and centuries that describe humans as kind of fallen wild creatures that need to be tamed, need to be made civil, made moral.
There certainly is that tradition, but there's also the other tradition from Rousseau that says it's society that corrupts people, and it's the condition that takes us away from our moral nature. I'm agnostic on the question, but it is interesting that when you see social codes that so clearly offend against what we think of as universal principles of morality, and yet people are able to see through them, where does that strength come from?
Mark Hauser, get more explicit if you can about the sort of physical or biological or evolutionary locus of this innate moral sense. Are you saying that there's some string of code in our DNA, some area of the mind, some mysterious continent of morality in our instincts? What is it, something material?
Okay, great. So absolutely, it's something material. But I think there's a way of unpacking this that begins to show how science can jump into the story. And I think what I'm trying to argue in the book is that we are potentially in a new period now, a very exciting period, where science can now begin to basically look into questions that have remained for centuries questions of pure philosophy. And now we have a chance to combine with philosophy to look at these questions. So here are some examples. When scientists interested in aspects of our species try to understand, are there things that are kind of species-typical, species-specific,
right,
a signature of a species, one of the first places to look is for evidence of universality, that we see common patterns of responses across wildly different kinds of cultures. So the first attempt at looking at this question that my students and I have explored is to create a website. People can find it. It's called the Moral Sense Test. And when you log into that website, you basically give information on who you are, your religious background,
yep,
educational background, and you proceed to take a series of moral dilemmas.
Mm-hmm.
What we are finding in these cases of various kinds of moral dilemmas involving helping and harming others is that to a large extent, the sample we have, factors like religious background, age, education, make little impact on the kinds of judgments people deliver.
But why wouldn't that be? Because over a millennia, all cultures have figured out that certain things don't work. Murder doesn't work that well. Too much adultery, and you've got social disarray right on down the line.
Okay, true.
Why do you assume it's evolution or biology?
Excellent. So the first thing is that biology, of course, creates systems to learn. So I don't want to dissociate biology from learning. I don't want to make the nature-nurture distinction, because that's going to get us into trouble. The point is that the biology is setting up ways of acquiring, or as biologists have noted, sort of the instinct to learn. So now let's look carefully at this idea. Let's say that we just learned it. We were taught these rules.
Mm-hmm.
Based on that idea, when we ask people to distinguish why one kind of moral dilemma is permissible,
mm-hmm,
but another one is not, they should be able to explain what the justification is.
Mm-hmm.
But what we find in many cases is that people haven't a clue.
Tom's calling from Portsmouth. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for covering this topic. Professor Hauser, I'm a layman. I'm not a scientist. But I do think about this subject, and I would agree just generally, that it is biologically based. And it seems to me it simply stems from the fact that the human being is a group animal. We live in clans and families, and so that there seems to be an innate need to get along. So that, you know, it's not so much from the religious or what we perceive to be the spiritual sector that morality and love and tolerance flow, but from the biological sector.
But Tom, let me ask you, if you're inclined to believe it's biological, why are we so much less successful on the moral front than, let's say, the reproductive front, or, you know, so many other evolutionarily provided behaviors?
Well, it doesn't mean that we can't still make a mess of things, which we seem to be doing. We're just talking about a tendency, but we're not necessarily talking about the ability always to follow through. There are a lot of other forces.
Mark Hauser, how about it? We are innately moral because we are we live in groups, and that's kind of a survival tool for getting along, being successful in groups.
So this is a nice question, I mean, in part because it brings together two kinds of questions. One is the mechanisms, the processes in the mind, the brain, that allow us to judge things as moral or not. And the second one, which the caller is bringing in, is what might have been selected for? Why is it adaptive? And what the caller is suggesting
by
is—
By evolution.
By evolution. Mm-hmm. So by Darwinian mechanisms, mm-hmm, of selection, you favor behaviors that are going to basically support group coordination and cooperation. I think what's so interesting about us as a species, and I think it's true actually of many species, not just sort of uniquely human, is that we have this tension within us between cooperation for good, because it actually benefits us as individuals,
mm-hmm,
and also defecting and cheating. And so there's been a long tension within the field of economics where there's been a very dominant model, sort of the self-interest rational model, where we do things to maximize our own self-interest. And yet now more and more, when various kinds of behavioral economic games are played, what we see is that people tend to lean in a direction which is to engage in fairness. So let me give, you know, a very simple example.
Mm.
There's a wonderful game called the Ultimatum game, and it goes like this. Two people come into a room. They don't know each other. They don't see each other. One plays the role of a donor. The other plays the role of a recipient. The
right.
donor is going to make some offer of a proportion of $10 to the recipient.
Okay.
If the recipient accepts, that's the end of the game. The recipient gets what was offered. The donor gets what's left over. But if the recipient rejects, neither get any money. Now, if you have the self-interest model, the donor should give the smallest amount possible because that maximizes his or her self-interest, and the recipient should accept because some money is better than no money. And yet, when this game is played, donors typically give between $4 to $6,
mm-hmm.
and recipients reject less than about $3, which goes very much against self-interest models.
Well, but let's see. If you're the donor, you want to, and you know you're not going to get anything if they reject?
You know the rules, and so does the recipient, okay. and you're never going to see this person again.
So you want to give
game.
Them enough that you end up getting something. So isn't self-interest still at work here?
That's right. So on the one hand, you should give enough if you have a view of maximizing how much comes back to you,
mm-hmm.
right? But think about it from the recipient's perspective. Mm-hmm. Why should a recipient reject any amount of money? $1, you came in with nothing. $1 is better than no dollars.
So in other words, it offends their sense of equity.
Equity, fairness, right.
But they're not in control in that situation.
Well, they are in control because the recipient rejects.
They blow it all away. They'd rather have nothing than an
That's
unfair
right.
offer.
So the idea is that when this game is played across many parts of the Western world, that's what you get. Now, interestingly, one last point is that when this game is played in small-scale hunter-gatherer societies, the Hadza of Tanzania and so forth, what you find is that everyone seems to have some notion of fairness, but the degree to which they count as a fair exchange varies by culture. That seems to be a reflection of the local cultural ecology. So some places will offer 15%, some will offer 50%, some never reject. But you never get 70% offers. You never get 0% offers. So it's constrained, and that gives a signature of the biology at work.
Jack Beatty, okay, there's Huckleberry Finn on the table and Mark Hauser, but are you buying the bread and the bone issue here? Our caller Tom says, well, of course, we're social animals. So evolution has selected us to be more moral because that's what it takes to get along. And yet, what's a war? What's a murder?
Well, right. I remember reading Conrad Lorenz years ago, the zoologist, and he was talking about wolves fighting. And he said when wolves fight, there comes a point in the fight where one wolf, I guess the one that's losing, will expose his jugular vein to the other one. And then the fight stops. There is an intra-species check on aggression. And there's nothing like that with
us. In other words, here's my vein. You could have it, but you don't have to because I've made the gesture.
That's right. And mm-hmm. because we are of the same species and we have this instinct that prevents us from killing one another within the same species.
Among wolves, you say, the dominant one backs off, but not humans.
Not human beings. So that this moral sense, this is a pretty weak read. If we're talking biology, that's a good example of biology as a very strong constraint on behavior. But there's nothing as strong as that, it seems to me, with human beings, which makes one wonder about its power.
Is it worth the status of the tension that you're giving it, Mark Hauser, if it's that weak a read? I mean, how do you look at the history of murder and mayhem and warfare and exploitation and all that's immoral? How does that stack up against the strength of this moral instinct or grammar?
Well, let's go to Jack's comment. I mean, this is an interesting issue, in part because it brings it back to animals, my favorite topic. But two things. One is, I mean, Chris Hedges, I can't remember the name of the wonderful book on war,
mm-hmm.
Notes this common fact about if you look at the history of the Earth, there's been of the human Earth, let's say, there's been very few periods in time where there hasn't been a war somewhere on the planet.
Certainly not now.
Right. But now imagine a newspaper filled with all the things that are going on that are not war and not violent. It would be an incredibly boring newspaper. It would be thousands and thousands and thousands of pages long.
You're going to tell us that the 30 million people who died in the 20th century are less consequential or immaterial compared to all the daisies that were picked and all the baths that were given to babies?
Not less consequential, but it goes back to Jack's point about us not having a mechanism to inhibit violence. And here's where I think, coming back to your earlier question about the biology, really begins to be quite interesting. Let's take psychopaths as an example of a kind of person who does what we think as immoral. They kill people. Increasing studies of the brain are beginning to reveal possibilities of certain parts of the brain which may be damaged or that have had problems early in development, particularly areas linking those parts of our emotional aspects of processing with those involved with decision-making that fail to inhibit violent tendencies.
But are you? But you're describing those. Those are outliers. Those are psychopaths. Those are a great minority among us. And yet, almost all human beings participate in immoral behavior of one kind or another. So it still comes back to the notion, if this is something provided by evolution, by eons, if it's biological, why is it so weak? Why is there so much immorality in spite of it?
Well, let's go back to
the distinction. We don't forget to eat, but we forget to be moral.
Well, I mean, you know, there's an awful lot of helping as well in the world. So let's keep in mind there's two things going on here. There's what we I want to come back to the distinction I made early on and keep coming back to it.
Yep.
Let's not forget the distinction between what we do and how we judge.
Hey, but it's a distinction which may not be consequential enough. Let's say that you're right, that we know when we're doing wrong, and we know that from evolution. So what? I mean, I, at that point, I'm from the show-me state. If we make the war anyway, if we murder anyway, then isn't this the weak reed that Jack describes?
Well, I mean, the question is what the focus is. I mean, I think let's make a – I mean, let's come back to this distinction. We can ask the question, why is it that humans do so many horrible things? That's one question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm asking a different question, which is a question I think science can begin to address.
Mm-hmm.
And that is there any sense in which us as a species has certain ways of viewing the world in terms of what's morally right or wrong? What we choose to do is a question of free will. It's a question of our emotions. It's a question of our education, our question of our religious background.
Mm.
It's a question that is a very complicated one that science may not be able to answer. This is not a book, nor is it a scientific project that says, I'm going to explain everything that we want to know about morality. That would be the ultimate in chutzpah.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going that way.
But you're putting a lot of stock in this moral bone, this moral muscle, enough that you're encouraging us to think about divorcing religion and morality, about backing away from moral reasoning. I want to let our callers in here. Julie's calling from Mystic, Connecticut. Hi, Julie. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure about this, but I was thinking that perhaps the very fact that we do have things like religion and government and law would argue for the fact that there is something in us that's biological, that's trying to behave morally, but there are other instincts obviously that get in the way. But I think if we weren't moral at all biologically, I don't think that cultures universally would have created cultural institutions like that.
But what about the argument, Julie, that says, well, we're not moral, but we've used our moral reasoning to figure out that we need structures like government, perhaps like religion? Could you make just the opposite argument off the same evidence?
Well, I don't. That sounds so pragmatic, though. I don't know.
Yeah, it's good.
Maybe you're right. I really am just kind of talking off the cuff, but it just seems as if it can't be simply that we're trying to get along. I think it's got to be something deeper than that.
Let us pick it up. It's wonderful, Julie. Thanks for your call, Mark. How about it? Government and all the rest as an expression of an innate morality, or as kind of prosthesis added on to save us from ourselves?
I mean, I think Julie's comments are very good in the sense that it's what does religion and government do that in some sense makes us look very carefully possibly at how our biology is driving certain kinds of perceptions of the world. Let me just give a very explicit example to make, I think, to concrete. Take the fact that in almost every country, legal boards dealing with the medical world make a distinction between active euthanasia and passive euthanasia. Specifically, most countries block a doctor being able to give a patient suffering from a terrible disease,
mm-hmm.
An overdose.
Essentially poison. Them.
Poison, right? So, or what's often called mercy killing.
But you might deny them treatment.
Deny them treatment or deny them life support.
And so that would be considered
permissible, morally permissible. So in our country, for example, the American Medical Association explicitly makes that distinction. Okay. Now, if you look behind the scenes,
mm-hmm.
and you look at most hospitals throughout the world, there are doctors and nurses that are basically illegally giving overdoses because from their perspective, the distinction between an action and the omission of an action ultimately lead to the same point, the person dies,
mm-hmm.
and the intention is the same, to remove suffering.
What does this say about innate moral grammar or about structures of moral guidance?
So here's the idea. it looks like from very early on in development, this is work that we're now pursuing, grad students of mine are pursuing, is that we may have in us a biological bias to perceive actions that cause harm as worse than omissions that cause the same harm. And here is where the tension between how the biology gives us perceptions of the world is one thing, and what we prescribe may be something completely different. So, for example, in Belgium, the action-omission distinction for euthanasia has been banned. There's a country where if a body of doctors thinks that giving an overdose is the right thing to do, they do it.
But you are you saying by that that we should back away from some of the careful reasoning we've done? I mean, you write, this is a big statement. You write, the dominant moral reasoning view has generated failed policies in law, politics, business, and education. So what, we should stop moral reasoning?
We shouldn't stop moral reasoning, but we should begin to understand what the biology is doing. And here's a perfect example of why. If we are handed something like a bias towards seeing actions as worse than omissions, or another example we have, which is actually even more interesting, intended harms versus foreseen harms. People see the intended harm as being worse than a foreseen harm. And yet when you ask people why, they're incapable of recovering that distinction. If it's a distinction they're not aware of, could we be in a better position if we make people aware of those kinds of distinctions? Could we move into a more productive dialogue? For example, in education, to make children aware that action omissions may not be the kind of distinction that one wants to make when one is attributing moral rights and wrongs.
So we're going to add another wing to the government that after a law is passed says, we turn to the courts, and we turn to the executive and the democratically elected legislature, then we turn to the scientists and say, does this line up with biological human morality?
Not does it line up in the sense that if it doesn't line up, therefore we should follow the biology. That's completely committing the naturalistic fallacy. We don't want to go from what biology can help us understand to a prescriptive view, which says this is what we ought to do.
Jane's calling from East Hampton, New York. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My thought is that it's not morality that is biological, but the capacity for empathy, the capacity to put yourself in another's shoes and to say, would I like this done to me? No, I wouldn't. Therefore, I won't do it.
And so we don't need to get as fancy as morality, simple empathy maybe.
Yes, and that's why the outliers, like a psychopath, do what they do, because they lack this capacity.
Jane, thanks very much for that. Mark Hauser, how about it? You don't need to go as far as morality. Empathy.
Jane, thanks. That's a very nice comment. And I think it brings us way, way back into the history of philosophy to David Hume, who really argued that the way to think about our moral sense was not through reason. In fact, reason is not what starts driving the story, but rather our passions, our emotions. And empathy, or in his term, sympathy, was really what was at the core of that idea. I think the issue here is not to see them as in opposition, that's either morality or empathy, but that things like our emotions are a part of the story. And one of the things that we're pushing very much in our own work is whether emotions follow from our moral judgments or are the source of our moral judgments. In Hume's terms, we derive our moral intuitions from our emotions. But the argument that we're trying to push is that there may be kind of a cold calculus that's unemotional at all altogether, that basically looks at aspects of what is cause, what is intended, and the consequences. That gives us our intuitive moral judgments, and that may then trigger our emotions, like empathy.
Jerry's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good. What do you think, Jerry?
Yeah, I agree with Dr. Hauser's basic premise. I wanted to get his take on some of the theories from in cultural evolution that war is just another means of harnessing the value of economic integration, that through war you get the harmony that comes from everyone, societies working together to produce bigger economic gains for the group.
So you're prepared to stand back and say war is a moral good once all the blood is seeped away and the dust is settled?
Yes, it's a way of waging peace, yes, and in the long run, yes.
Wow. Okay. An extreme example. Mark Hauser, what do you say?
Well, I'm not sure I have a good answer for Jerry. It's not sort of the area I traffic in, but let me just respond to a couple of points. I think the interesting thing, this brings back actually a comment that Jack Beatty made earlier, which is sort of the view about Rousseau and kind of the peaceful human species. My colleague at Harvard, Richard Wrangham, an anthropologist, has described us as Rousseauian at home and Hobbes abroad.
And, it's a jungle outside, and the basic, hearth at home.
You know, and the basic idea is that if you compare humans, and this goes back again to something that Jack said earlier, if you compare humans with other species, one of the remarkable things about humans as a species is how, in some sense, peaceful we are with members of our own species when we don't even know who they are. I mean, I've just sort of recently, met Tom. If this was two chimpanzees, we'd be killing each other within a few minutes. I would never sit tolerably with another chimpanzee that I did not know that was not part of my group. Hmm. But humans do this all the time. So in that sense, we're peaceful at home. But when we meet others from other communities, we are much more aggressive and warring in the Hobbesian sense. So I think the idea that in wartime we are harnessing economic resources, I mean, certainly the history tells us that's basically largely true. I think the interesting thing is how we're able to cooperate across groups at very, very large scale, something we do not see at all in any other species. No other species shows the level of large-scale cooperation to harness resources that our own species does. This is absolutely a unique part of our species heritage.
Even when we cooperate in wreaking death and destruction.
Well, that's right, because, I mean, I think the other part of our innate biology, so to speak, and again, something engaged by this moral grammar, is the notion of an outgroup. We very quickly form outgroup distinctions. When we do form those distinctions, we immediately peg them as vermin, parasites, and so forth. They're horrible.
Do you see that as a challenge to your theory? Because that, in terms of, let's say, universal religions, of course, they have in and out groups too, but there's a lot of appeal to universality, to the brotherhood, the sisterhood of mankind, of womankind. I mean, is that readiness to label, identify an outgroup a fundamentally, biologically immoral impulse?
I think it leads to often immoral behavior. I mean, I think the notion of a universal brother from religion, I mean, I think the history again shows that those are words without much content. If you look at the history of violence that's often been inspired by religious distinctions, the outgroup is something that's as prominent within religious history as in anything else.
But could religion then be an attempt to reach behind whatever morality nature does provide us to say it's good, but it's not enough?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there's absolutely no question that religion is trying to do such things, to find ways in which behaviors that may lead to temptation can be controlled. But here's, again, where I think some of the interesting work coming out of our own studies is highly suggestive at this point. If you look, for example, at the kinds of moral dilemmas we've given people, and you simply ask the question, do people who claim to be religious of whatever kind, Catholic, Jewish, Buddhist, whatever it is, do they give different kinds of moral judgments as opposed to people who say they're atheists?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is no. To a large extent, your religious background is not having a substantial effect on the kind of judgment you make in these situations.
But you take it a step further.
Yep.
You write that the marriage between morality and religion is not only forced but unnecessary, crying out for a divorce. Why would you pull those two apart?
I think the point is exactly the reason I gave is that because what you see is that underlying what has been rehearsed in religion, people have been told this is the way you should act. If you divorce those kinds of situations and give people classes of dilemmas that are fairly abstract, people judge them to be the same in terms of what's morally permissible or not, independently of the religion. That's the separation that I'm looking for. That's not to say that people can't derive an extraordinary amount from religious background, that religions give them strength, it guides them in terms of what they want to do, but underlying that is a common core that goes below what religion's doing.
But what's religion if you divorce it from morality? I mean, maybe you'll say if you don't need religion to come to morality, then it's just unnecessary. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, again, I mean, I think this is where I think, that the tricky part of the book is, it sounds like we're going to keep coming back to it. It's the difference between what we do and the rules that guide us do that as opposed to how we judge things. The science is at the level of not explaining what people will actually do in a certain situation. It's going to guide how people judge situations to be morally permissible or not. So again, religion in this situation is a set of explicit rules. Mm-hmm. What we are uncovering with our scientific studies are, in some cases, rules that are unconscious altogether. People have no knowledge that they are operating in terms of forcing their moral judgments.
So science trying to surface everything here. Mark is calling from San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. You started talking about what I was going to ask about, and which is sort of where you have members of your group and then members of the other.
Yes.
Even when it comes to sort of defining murder, people have a hard time defining that. It sort of comes down to murder is killing the people you're not allowed to kill. However, you're certainly allowed to kill people on the other side, you know, the vermin, the terrorists.
So in war, it's not murder in our standard construction.
Right, uh-huh.
So what do you take from that?
Well, I think that we have, you know, maybe this moral relativism that people complain about is very innate, and it's a mechanism to solidify a group against another group. And I think actually one of the main functions of religion has been to cement groups together, and using the idea of morality in some cases to motivate them against the other group.
Does it leave you more likely to believe that we've got a moral instinct, or less likely to believe that, Mark?
Well, I think that I believe we have a moral instinct. I just maybe think it's probably not the sort of bright and shiny thing that you may believe it is.
Mm-hmm. Dappled, maybe, here. Let's get another call. Thanks very much, Mark. A call from St. Louis. Mike is on the line. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great show. One of my pet topics here, morality. Morality, to me, seems to be a choice-based concept that is internally generated, and it does serve the self-interest, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
Your guest earlier suggested this money game, and my thought immediately was, well, that's a separate concept. The self-interest is fed by the fairness, and that's all part of the internal morality that everybody has.
Okay.
When we create laws that sort of codify this, we ossify concepts, and they become less. They break down because they now are no longer a moral choice.
But we think of lawlessness as a state of barbarism, Mike.
Well, yeah. I mean, we need laws, but we essentially use laws as leverage to sort of define our own morality. And that what that does is then it creates a context of immorality with the apparent appearance of morality.
So we can codify immorality if we're not careful.
Exactly. You see it in many of the things we've seen in the news in recent years with the Enrons and the WorldComs, where they acquired laws that clearly, if you looked at them, you say, well, that doesn't make sense, but it's the law, and it creates this whole, again, perversion of what is legal and what is moral.
So maybe our mind and our interests getting in the way of our instincts. Mike, thanks for calling from St. Louis. Mark Hauser, how about it? You're skeptical of what you describe as failed policies in law, politics, business, education, and you turn around and blame moral reasoning for getting us to those failed policies.
let me take the two comments by Mark and Mike and try to put some flesh on these. These are very nice comments. The in-group, out-group distinction is one that really actually has some real force here when we think about the notion of a kind of a universal set of principles. Let's take the notion of, and you started the show this way, Tom, killing is wrong. I mean, if you take that view, ultimately you quickly will see that that can't be the moral rule in all its fullness because, of course, we can think of all sorts of ways in which we do both support killing of others and actually in some cases make it obligatory.
We shoot the guy who's on a killing spree from the tower with the high-powered rifle.
Exactly. So, and in some cultures, for example, infanticide is something that is actually not only just permissible, but it's actually expected by people. The one I want to pick up on, and it actually was from your previous show, was the notion of an honor killing.
Mm-hmm.
It was mentioned in the previous show about Osama bin Laden.
Let's say when a young woman's honor is offended in some cultures.
That's right. So here's an interesting distinction between the East and the West. If you go back to our history in the United States, in the South, if you found your spouse, typically the wife, in bed with somebody else, it was not only sort of permissible to kill. It was almost obligatory. It was part of the culture to kill. Now, of course, the law wasn't saying go out and kill your spouse, but the level of punishment delivered to somebody who did that was very, very different.
Was that innate morality speaking?
Well, I mean, the notion of what counts as a local cultural variant, I think, is. The crucial point here is, in the same way that within language, you've got abstract grammatical principles that then get sort of set to specific details for a given language. That's what I want to argue here for morality. You've got an abstract notion of when killing is permissible. The local culture will flip on a switch that says, here is the class of individuals for which that's permissible. In the East, honor killings are different in that the person who is expected to do the killing is not the husband, but rather family members of the spouse. So here you have the killing is going to happen for the spouse, but the culture is going to vary. Who does the work?
Our time is short. Let me ask you this final question. If we've got evolution at work here and morality is embedded in it, do you expect progress? Do you expect more and more moral humans to emerge?
I mean, here the answer, I think, is simply is yes, and it's in the following sense. I think this is where reasoning comes into play. I think if you look at the history, certainly with our own country, we've taken many situations that at one point were morally permissible, slavery, treatment of animals, and so forth, and we've turned around and said that's not how the world should be. That's not the moral world that we want it to be. So the critical point here is not to interpret a biological system as being fixed and immutable and guiding what we will do and what we ought to do, but rather they're constraints that we should understand. The more we understand them, the better I think we can make moral progress as opposed to less.
Jack, you're going to count on biology to propel a little morality forward here?
Well, you know, there's a whole tradition of feeling that that's the wrong way to look. I mean, social Darwinism was a misapplication of biology, but there was something to it, the idea of competition and so on. I'm with Jane. I mean, if someone said to me, okay, stand and deliver, what is morality? I would say that's it. It's empathy. And the essence of that, I think a character in a Carson McCullers play says, is to know the we of me. Mm-hmm. When people begin to see the we of me, that then they can act, it seems to me, in a moral way. Maybe that's universal biological morality, but maybe also that is all about nurture and love and the circumstances of our maturation. I don't know, but if someone said, what is it? That's what I'd say.
Well, here we are. Science has its nose under the flap of yet another tent here, and it's very interesting where this all may go. Mark Hauser, thank you so much for your research and for your time today. The book is Moral Minds, How Nature Designed Our Universal Sense of Right and Wrong. Professor Hauser, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Pleasure.
Jack, I want to turn for just a moment. It's the day after Labor Day. Summer's fading behind us, and just say hello to you again. Welcome to a new season. I've just come back from a couple of weeks of vacation, and it gives a person a certain perspective on the world. We've got big things coming up, but can I tell you what I did on my summer vacation, Jack?
I want to know.
Well, let's see. It was an unusual one. I spent my first 5 days farming with my daughter, my young daughter. We went off to a place that encourages sustainable agriculture through an organization called the Heifer Project. A lot of our listeners may know it. They send livestock to lots of developing countries overseas and to corners of this country. And I just farmed for 5 days, Jack. Milked cows and herded steers and herded goats and slopped the hogs and saw the stars. It was absolutely great.
You were grounding yourself in the immemorial rhythms of nature.
Well, you know, doing the show day after day, I mean, every once in a while, you've got to stand back and feel that rhythm. I don't know if it's Mark Hauser's moral instinct or just some fresh air, but it was great. I went down to New York City, to Queens, and helped an old friend bury his mother, who was a great friend of mine. Sort of was my first home away from home on the East Coast. Wonderful, wonderful woman. We picked her ashes up at this terrific black funeral home in Queens where Marcus Garvey's posters were on the wall and quotes from Bob Marley about the black man standing up. And I felt so, you know, kind of embraced by her, even though she was gone. Milroy Levitt, may she live forever in our minds. But, you know, reaching back to an old friendship and restoring it, even at that sad time, very restoring as well. And then a little time in the islands, Nantucket, no less, which was absolutely beautiful, the beach there, even though the sky was gray. Have you had a good summer, Jack?
Well, yes, I've mostly spent mine in the library trying to finish off a book about America in the late 19th century, and I've had the feeling that I'm looking in a mirror. As I look at the first Gilded Age, I see so much of today's Gilded Age. So, in a way, I've been trying to escape from the present, but I keep bumping into it in the rearview mirror of history.
Well, in the front view mirror, we've got quite a season coming up. I've got a powerful sense of living in times of such consequence, such decisions for this democracy to make. And you can see the sort of need for decisions crying out all over the place when you step out of the studio or out of the library and look around. Jack, I'm looking forward to diving into this new season with you and unfolding it every which way we can.
Well, we've been at it now for 5 years, and we started on a very inauspicious time. Mm. And let's hope we see better times ahead. We started right after September 11th.
Yeah, well, we've got crickets outside, and the sun sinks a little earlier. But, hey, it's a whole new day, and I can't wait to dive into it with you. Jack, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.